Indiana got too many chances to demonstrate last year its preparedness to deal with difficult events, floods and multiple tornadoes. My thanks to all those whose leadership or volunteer efforts made it possible for us to come through those days and take care of our own. As the world has now learned, there are other events, new events for which we must be prepared. One of those is the so-called avian flu. We want to bring our fellow citizens current today about plans that the state has been forced to make against that possibility. We have a statewide plan now in being under the leadership of Eric and Dr. Monroe. We now have 92 local plans which have been prepared and vetted. Many local exercises have taken place around the state, and many more will be necessary. On March the 23rd, these two folks will be convening a statewide meeting to push these preparedness plans further forward and to make sure we're as ready as we can be in the case that this pandemic does begin here in the United States. I'll ask Judy in a moment to speak about the state of play medically and scientifically. We just want our fellow citizens to know, first of all steps that we can think of to take are being taken, and that if, perish the thought, we should have to implement this plan, life would be very different in Indiana, at least for a while. It contains steps that most of us have not seen in our lifetime, steps like the quarantine of infected victims, the isolation of victims, the quarantine of those who have been in contact with those victims, the cancellation of major public events of all kinds. All these things might be brought into play. And with good fortune and effective work elsewhere in the world, let's hope none of them will be necessary. But the public needs to know that folks are working on this, have thought about this, and are getting the state ready in the event we should ever have to take steps like that to make sure that the damage to human health in Indiana is minimized. Let me ask Judy just to say a word or two. There have been some developments, and many of them widely reported.
That's correct.
In the epidemiology of this disease, and without overstating the case, they simply, I think, underscore the fact that we do have to be ready, that it is not impossible that we would have to deal with this problem in a very aggressive way.
The most recent news is that the avian flu is now in Africa, so now we have three continents where the birds have been infected, and it, again, I'd emphasize that this is an avian flu. It's infecting birds, human life across the world. We've lost, there have been about 165 people infected with about a 50% mortality rate worldwide, but those are only people that have been in contact with the sick birds. There's been perhaps a couple of human-to-human cases, so we don't have a situation where we have human-to-human spread, and that's the concern. If the virus should mutate and become a virus that easily is transmitted from one human to another, that's the major concern that we have, and that is not happening at this time, which puts us in a great position to be preparing for the possibility, and that's what our state plan is all about. What individuals can do is good hand washing, and we ask people to sneeze in tissues, to carry tissues with them, and then discard those tissues and, again, wash their hands. Families can be preparing by putting food supplies together, but that's just good preparedness for anything, whether it's avian flu that we're concerned about versus anything else. And then our state, as Governor Daniels has said, we have a statewide plan. All the counties are on board. Everyone's working toward making sure that we understand how to get antivirals distributed in the event that we would need to do that, or if we need to do mass prophylaxis of any type if we have a vaccine in place. So a lot of planning is taking place, and we just ask everyone to go to the website and update themselves and understand the plan.
Thanks.
They can go to the ISDH. It's on the ISDH website.
Thanks, Doctor.
With the 83 cases, Dr. Rory said that was 163 worldwide. I mean, this plan of 6 billion people, is it really that much of a problem at this point?
That's right. Yeah. And again, at this point, it's worldwide. We're doing the surveillance and watching the behavior of this particular virus. But in the scheme of things, very few people have been infected with the virus to date.
There's some quarantine legislation, I think, going to the General Assembly. Is that all related to the
NDP? I honestly don't know, but there is already statutory authority for the Commissioner of Health to take these very serious measures. Again, these are measures that most of us, thank goodness, have never seen in our lifetime, the complete isolation of people who have been victimized by disease, the quarantine of people who are not allowed to leave perhaps their house for extended periods just because they've been in contact. These were severe enough measures in the 19-teens and at other times in our history. They would have very profound consequences today if we ever had to undertake them. So with luck and, as I say, effective work on many other fronts, we won't ever have to take them. But as Hoosiers have learned, again, very recently, it's our duty to be prepared, and we've asked these folks to make sure Indiana can be as ready as anywhere if the need should arise. Well, let your imagination run, but, you know, large sporting events, for instance, I suppose, come right to the top of the list.
What would be the trigger, essentially? I mean, there would be a point, presumably, where the State Department of Health would have to test to confirm that it was indeed avian flu or something of that nature. I don't know if that would be done hourly. Maybe it would take a couple of days. I mean, what's the trigger from... We obviously want to get this started early to cut it early, but at the same time, it's probably going to take a little while to make that determination.
Well, and that's one of the things, as part of the preparedness, we're working to increase our surveillance and be able to have more timely testing, turning around the testing. Actually, our state laboratory, we just got word this week through CDC that we will be one of the sites that will be able to test at our state laboratory for the H5N1 virus. Which obviously will have our turnaround quicker. Most likely the scenario would be that if the virus comes to the United States, the most likely scenario would be that we will obviously know about that probably from another state, and then obviously we'd up our surveillance. But we're already working toward that with our technology. Right now in Indiana, it'll be just the state laboratory that would be able to do the testing. I'm not sure total how many CDC had designated. I'm sorry.
Dr. Monroe, are you comfortable that the nation as a whole is as prepared as it needs to be, since Indiana would still be vulnerable, obviously, if other states weren't prepared?
Sure. I think when you're talking about a pandemic, just by the nature of a virus that could have this type of effect on human beings, because it's a novel virus, we don't have any natural immunity to this virus, which makes it the danger that it is, we will always be working toward improving our preparedness. So we are more prepared today than we certainly were a year ago, and with it, every day that passes, we are improving that preparedness. But it's an ongoing quality improvement.
Yeah, I've spoken to Secretary Leavitt about this subject twice now, and I know that at the national level they're doing all they can. I can't speak for what other states have done or how far they've progressed, but it's not for lack of effort, I know, on the part of the national administration to get everybody to take this seriously and to take the kind of steps that Judy and Eric have led here in our state.
What is Homeland Security?
Primarily, we're concerned about continuity of operations and continuity of government. Obviously, if the worst case event happens, we could have a third of our emergency workers, a third of our public officials, a third of our healthcare workers out of their normal places of duty. And this is also an event that needs all of those people in mass at their place of duty. So it's paramount for us to worry about what we're going to do in these worst case scenarios, where we're going to look for extra help, and how we're going to respond in an effective way and make sure that we have the right decision makers in place even when the decision maker might not be feeling well or might not be there.
Governor, Senator Meeks has said major moves, there's a lot of work in it. Your reaction?
Well, it is about building roads and bridges. Pork usually, I think, is a term applied to maybe some that aren't too necessary. But everything that we would build with major moves is necessary. That's why we searched for this solution in the first place. We're trying to solve an enormous practical problem, Indiana's $3 billion transportation deficit. And the roads and bridges and perhaps airports and rail that would come from success with this bill, I tend to think are mandatory for a great economic future. Now, I think that what the senator is talking about is some of his colleagues wanting to carve off pieces for things that are less well defined. But he's a great sponsor to have on this bill, and I trust his judgment. And let me just say that I want to be very, very flexible about any changes that the legislature wants to make, as long as they preserve our ability to solve the great practical problem that has faced us here in Indiana for a long time. And I think the legislature ought to work its will, at least on the edges of this bill. I'm trying to keep my eye on the big prize, and that's hundreds of projects that otherwise won't get built, tens of thousands of jobs for this generation and the next, if we were able to put those public assets, long-term public assets in place.
How flexible can you be in light of the agreement that you've negotiated?
Well, there are some. We obviously couldn't accept something that would undo the bid, but I don't see anything that's been seriously proposed so far that goes to that point. You know, what you really have here is an opportunity so huge, particularly for the northern counties, that there's more money for those seven counties than anyone has any idea today what to do with. You build every project in those seven counties that we've thought of, give out lots of local money, and to them specifically, fund the Northwest RDA, and it still leaves $400 to $500 million. And that's what people are talking about. Maybe some of it should be dividended to motorists and to continue the toll structure that hasn't changed in 20 years. Maybe some of it should be used to create additional local RDAs. I'm very open-minded to these things. The good news is that the opportunity is so huge that some of that can be done and still allow us to close our transportation gap and take a huge economic step forward.
One of the things he says has to come out of the bill is the toll road county resident freeze. Doesn't that make it impossible to pass?
Now, as I understand his position, he prefers a different approach to that through an income tax credit or refund. But, what you have here is a healthy legislative process with a lot of people offering up ideas, and I think they'll eventually be compromised out. And I'm taking a very open stance toward all this. I'm just trying to get the big job done of securing a tremendous economic step forward for jobs in this state over the long term.
But some of the folks from northern Indiana have basically expressed a sentiment that this is, in their words, our road, we built it, we shouldn't have to pay. I mean, is that the right attitude to have? Because, every county could say, well, no, we don't want our tax dollars going up north or south.
Yeah. In my every public utterance, I've tried to get people to think about the good of the whole state and recognize we're all in this together, and this is a huge opportunity for us all. I happen to think it's very fair to the folks in those seven counties who get seven counties out of 92 get a third of all the funds. That's every penny attributable to any Indiana motorist, because two-thirds of the tolls are paid by folks from out of state. So I think it strikes most people when they look at it as fair, and once again, it leads to $1 billion or more that they won't have otherwise in those seven counties alone, more than right now people have a specific use for. That's a very nice problem to have, and it's an enormous contrast to what we've lived with for a long time, which is more than $2 of needs and promises for every $1 of funds.
Governor, how would you feel feel about carving I-69 out of the bill? There was questions about how during the current debate these toll road people have had the lease agreement, they've had different discussions they can have that we're not being able to have on the I-69 because we don't have any lease agreement for I-69 to look at right now. How would you feel about doing I-69 a second time and not
I think it belongs in this bill. The part of the bill that has gotten less attention than the lease proposal is simply the authority to explore so-called public-private partnership arrangements, which is probably the fast and most affordable way to build I-69. I think Indiana ought to have that authority. 18 states already do. It doesn't commit us to any particular arrangement, and any arrangement that we were offered, I think, ought to be one that we consult carefully with the legislators and the state about. But I think it'd be a terrible mistake to leave us without the tool, at least the opportunity, to go search for a deal like that. We might get one as outstanding as the offer we have for the lease.
You now have presented a very specific proposal. Is there anything in current law that would stop you from doing all those same things with other projects?
I don't think anybody would go to the time and very large expense of talking to us seriously about building a new road, a fundamentally different thing than operating as a contractor, a road that's in existence. Without knowing that at least the state had the authority to act on that. They'd be spending millions and millions of their own dollars to see what sort of proposal they could make to us. And again, 18 states have this authority, and Indiana should too. It gives us a new tool for projects that big, because our old way of doing it was not going to get it done, and it's time to build that road.
That broad authority, and I wonder, you're taking it in this case to transportation, to roads.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see yourselves having the power to take that broader? Could we see other state assets put in under private management, state parks, even like the state building authority, that sort of thing? Or do you see this something that is only best suited right now to transportation?
Certainly the idea of construction and operation of a hard asset like a road, I think is best suited to transportation. Nothing new about the fact that we often have public assets operated under contract by private company. That happens all over the place. And on that front, we just look for the best way to get a service delivered. Sometimes it's in the traditional fashion. Sometimes it's by hiring somebody whose skill in life is making food or cleaning buildings or perhaps running toll roads.
What evidence do you have so far that is the best way to do things? Has anything about the privatization of the prisons told you that privatization of the toll road is a better way to do things?
Oh, I don't know that you can leap. I don't know that you can leap from one to the other. We save tens of millions of dollars by carefully contracting things that the state was trying to do for itself before, and service has improved. And we just take it case by case and look for those opportunities. We're in a lot better shape now that the Newcastle prison will be open under private management, as opposed to hiring hundreds of Kentuckians to guard hundreds of Indiana prisoners at a premium cost. We're going to wind up saving money using what had been a white elephant facility. It was almost entirely empty. And hiring, by the way, 300 more Hoosiers in a county that needs the work. So if you are careful and apply this approach in the right places, it's a big win for taxpayers and for service recipients.
Governor, we keep hearing some anecdotal stories of phone calls and letters from large numbers of people who are opposed to leasing the toll.
Uh-huh.
You have said that you believe that over time it will be a popular idea.
Yeah.
Do you have any way of knowing at this point what the public really thinks?
No, I really don't. What I do know, I was on the road again yesterday, and talked to several legislators and also people from the huge coalition that is supporting our bill, is that as soon as you get a chance to talk to people, many of whom have had an innocent confusion, many of whom have been misled with false information, they start to understand that this is a terrific opportunity for our state. But it'll take a while for that word to spread. Ultimately, I think the results will out when people see the dreams of decades happening before their eyes in Indiana, and they'll realize it wasn't an accident and that it took bold and innovative action at this point in time. But, you know, one thing I take confidence from is there's probably not been a proposal for a long time that had as wide a support. All of the building trades essentially in this state, unions are interested in it because of the jobs. Every sort of business group has now looked at it and signed on. Local government, the Conference of Mayors, the county commissioners. And I think over time, our citizens who right now aren't sure what they think will draw some confidence from the credibility of this incredible array. And really, those who are trying to stop it are in a very isolated position right now.
The Internet columnist who initiated the Great Davis recall says there should be a ditch Mitch movement, that you are a tax and spend politician and a disappointing conservative. Any reaction?
Well, I hadn't heard it. We just passed the tightest budget in 55 years. We're balancing a budget that had been out of whack for 10 years in one. We're paying off the debts of the state. Taxes have not gone up one nickel. I don't know what state this person is from, but maybe they ought to move to Indiana and catch up to the facts.
Governor, I understand you had a meeting this morning with Superintendent Reed. I wondered what the substance of that meeting was and whether you guys have come to any meeting of the minds on our stuff.
Well, we have frequent conversations, and we talked about a number of subjects. I'm not going to go into the details of it, but it was constructive and friendly and fun, like all our conversations tend to be.
If Major Moose goes through the legislature you cited, should anyone who didn't vote for it stay away from groundbreaking ceremonies for the next 10 years?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, they'll be welcome. It should be awkward for them. And people have just voted against projects they've issued press releases about all their political careers, and they'll have some explaining to do. But as far as I'm concerned, folks have a right to come to their senses. And as we build Indiana's future, thanks to the wisdom and courage of the majority that is voting for, that's going to vote for this, I think those who tried to stand in its way ought to be welcomed back to the fold. And I certainly would never tell anybody they shouldn't be there.
Well, we've got Homeland Security here. Yesterday, the President unveiled the foiled threat to the library tower. Have you been made aware of any threats to anything in Indiana?
The simple answer is no. We don't know of any specific threats in Indiana or even any general threats in Indiana.
And you believe that they would have alerted you if there had been?
Yes.
That missile threat on the Channel 6 studios we decided was a hoax, is that?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Okay.
Are you in any, either even preliminary discussions about anything that's the next step after Major Moves, assuming it passes, the next area of state government that you want to negotiate privatization for?
No, and that mistakes our intent completely. You know, when we came to office, Indiana had twin deficits. One in its state government budget, which had been in the red for years and owed money to schools and so forth. And we're fixing that faster than most people thought. The second was a transportation deficit. We talked about it very openly. And when you asked me, I can remember in the second or third quarter of last year, what will be in next year's plan. I always started with transportation. We've got to find a way to close that gap. As I told audiences in Peru and Michigan City and Merrillville and places yesterday, the state really had four choices, three legitimate and one not. The legitimate choices were try somehow to tax and borrow your way to close this gap. We couldn't really have gotten it closed, but theoretically, you could have done that. I think it would have been terrible policy and probably politically impossible. Doubling or more the gas tax, borrowing money to the hilt, not a good idea. Choice two, cancel half the projects. come clean, just admit you're never going to build 69. You're not going to build the Heartland. You're not going to build 31 because we can't. Choice three, find some new way to fund it. Look for other people's money. We did and we found it. The illegitimate choice, the non-option to me, was to continue a policy of pretense that said to Indiana year after year after year, we're for you, we're for all those things, and we're going to do them someday, knowing there was no possibility of paying for it. And that policy really had to end in favor of a policy of being truthful with our fellow citizens and then trying to be innovative about solving this practical problem. And that's just has nothing particularly to do with whether you deliver a different service in the traditional way or through some contract.
Governor, in the past you've suggested that the current tolls on the toll road are too low because the previous governors lacked the political will to raise them. When we talk about doing an income tax credit for tolls, mm-hmm. can you do it in a way that will ensure that we're spending lease proceeds on that, not general dollars, and that the thing will sunset so that we're not paying 100 years from now because previous or future lawmakers don't have the political will to take that back?
Well, first of all, I think my observation simply has been that to note that the tolls have not changed in 20 years, that they are much lower than most comparable roads, and I'm not being critical of anybody. That's just the way it is, and that the toll road's not paying for itself lately, and that with or without a lease, you know, we proposed raising those tolls, modernizing them, before I had any idea whether it would ever have a lease to recommend or not. One way or another, I thought that had to happen because the road at least had to pay for itself. And if we don't make expansions of the kind the contractor is going to make, congestion's going to really be difficult up there. So that's really what I have always said. The with regard to the idea of a dividend or a continued freeze, at least for residents of certain counties, I'm open to that. Clearly, it should be seen that way, a dividend from the trust fund, a use of some of those surplus monies that right now are far in excess of all the projects that we know about. But if that's what folks in that part of the state would like to do with it, I'm very open to that. I want to be defer as long as it doesn't run too far and begin to invade the money we need to finish the projects on the books.
But if the tolls haven't been increased in 20 years, haven't these people been using the toll road basically for nothing?
Well, I wouldn't say nothing. And there was a day, they tell me, decades and decades ago, when people imagined it might one day become a free road. So I think it's a fair notion. Again, if it's the will of folks up there to use the funds as a let's say a dividend or maybe a reward to long-term users of the road, as opposed to holding them in trust for future hard dollar or hard asset investments, you know, up to some reasonable point, I'd want to support their will.
Should we actually, sorry to go back to the previous issue here. Obviously, Indiana is not working in a vacuum in terms of putting together plans for to deal with avian flu. Is Indiana's plan guided, say, in part by the CDC? Is it based on potentially what other states do?
Yes, absolutely. We're working closely with the CDC as well as Health and Human Services. CDC actually reviewed our plan and you know gave us the green light on the plan.
The only other question I had in regards to that is, we've seen, say, for example, maybe with Hurricane Katrina, that the public's willingness to sit around and wait for say, immunizations, in this particular case, depends somewhat on their perception of whether or not the state or any government agency is willing to respond in the manner that in the time frame they want to see it done. If we have situations like quarantine, where people are stuck in their house because they were in contact with someone with the avian flu, how soon could they expect to get that immunization, to get that response from the state?
That's a great question. First of all, I'd like to back up. What we would like to have and what we need is really the cooperation of the public, and so that's why everyone needs to be educated about the threat of the pandemic influenza, but really any contagious disease that might come along of this nature. So we would really want people to be on a voluntary basis, you know, going isolating themselves or quarantining themselves without us having to come in and mandate that. So that's the best case scenario. And then if we needed to quarantine, we would do that. In terms of being able then to get them testing, that's going back to that. If someone's quarantined because they've been exposed, then it will depend on the technology at that moment, and that's what we're improving. Like, as soon as we can test for H5N1 here in the state, we'll be able to turn that testing around quicker than we would be able to do today, as an example. So it all depend on at what point in time the scenario might play out.
I guess what I mean is, you know, someone's not going to sit there and if they think, well, I'm just sitting here waiting to die, say, for example, there's going to be that certain amount of fear. I mean, what kind of setup is there that, yes, the state is watching over you, yes, you're going to be okay, you know, yes, you're not just going to sit there in the back and get the flu?
Well, and quarantine is for asymptomatic individuals. So when we talk about quarantine, that's someone that's been exposed, but they're not sick yet, and they may never become sick. So we would know if someone's quarantined, you're going to know in that first, you know, 1 to 4 days whether they're going to develop any symptoms, at which point then they would get treatment. I mean, we would certainly swoop in and have whatever treatment is available at that time, whether that's antivirals that may be available or if there are vaccines. Now, at the time that a vaccine is available, any time that we would have a vaccine, depending on the quantities of that, we would want to get that out to people just as soon as possible. And that's why at the local level, they're exercising the plans to be able to do the mass prophylaxis or the mass vaccinations.
What are the symptoms?
So, quick as possible. Yes?
What are the symptoms?
It would be symptoms similar to the typical flu. People would get, they'd have malaise, they'd be tired, they'd get a cough, headache, fever, those types of symptoms. They may be more severe in the case of a pandemic. Those symptoms will be more severe than typical seasonal flu.
I have an unrelated question for Mr. Dietz. We've been seeing these lovely triangle barriers put up around the State House. I guess we're just trying to figure out where that's going. Some of them are in the middle of the road. They're kind of hard to see.
It's another creature comfort question here. We got water coolers. We got smoking. You know, it's all about.
Okay. I got another one after this.
Hey, don't we have a quota of one per availability? Okay, you can.
No, the intent is to routinely keep it open, but to begin to manage the road inside the government center, more like the airport driveway than the parking lot at the grocery store. Obviously, you guys probably all parked on that driveway today. We would rather you didn't do that, because just as easily as you could park there, somebody could find a van, paint channel 6 or 8 or whatever on the side of that and park it there in the same way, and that's a concern to us. We're adding to campus security, both by being able to close the driveway when we need to. When we don't need to close it, we're going to add to the footprint of security guards and officers that actually can manage that driveway, again, just like the airport. And all of us manage just fine with drop off at the airport and get back in the car and drive. And that's what we're looking for out here.
So you're closing down the parking?
No, I didn't say that.
No, I'm just trying to understand what those barriers actually do. I mean,
In the ground, there are bollards that are hydraulically actuated. So if we need to close the driveway, we bring the hydraulic bollards up, and the triangular barricades on the side block the other part where it would have been too expensive to buy so many bollards.
So those triangle, this is not my aesthetic question, or my question. Those triangle barriers, just like they are, those are permanent?
Yes.
I mean, they just look so out of place with the rest of the architecture.
They'll be filled with basically gravel and other weighting material to provide a vehicle barricade.
My unrelated question is that my office is in the ISTA building rather than up here, and I walk every day over to the State House across the front here, and I see people taking pictures of the State House and the big statue, and I just wondered if it's a permanent arrangement to have the garbage can and the no smoking sign out in front of the statue, everyone takes their picture in front of it.
I am clueless, but I'll As with the water cooler, I will jump right on the issue of the garbage can. Your man, Mitch, is on the job, but Leslie, I'm getting to the bottom of this. Yeah. Okay, I like to leave these meetings with one important assignment, and I've got it. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Eric, thanks a lot.